And we're holding on page 28 in Bava Kamma, Ois Lamed Vav, still in the middle of all of the things that Rava is asking Rava Bar Mori for a source in a pasuk for some concept that people say or that the Chachamim say. So, Omalei Rava L'Rava Bar Mori, Menoha Milsa Da'amri Inchi, where is there a source in Torah for the idea that people say, Metayo V'ozol Dikla Bisha, the bad palm tree goes and walks along and sticks together and it goes and walks and strolls along gabekina de shorchi together with the unemployed trees, so to speak. Shorchi Rashi says means betalim. They're not employed in the process of making fruit. So in other words, non-fruit bearing trees. So in other words, the point of the mashal is that the same way as you have like a tree like that, a palm tree that produces bad dates tends to associate with the trees that are non-fruit bearing. It's a figure of speech that people say. In other words, that people who themselves are, there's something the matter with them, they're not such good people, they tend to hang out with not good people as well. Omale, so Rabbi Bamori tells him, this one, there's not just one pasuk. Dover, this is so important, and this happens so often. Dover's a kosuva Torah. It says in Chumash, there's a pasuk that expresses this idea. Shonu b'Nevi'im, it's repeated again in Nevi'im, umashulash b'Ksuvim, and a third time in Ksuvim, utnan b'masnissin, and we have a Mishnah that expresses this concept, v'tnein b'braisa, and we learn it in a braisa. That's how common this kind of thing is, that a flawed person associates with other people who are flawed like him. We find in the Torah, when Esav is in the market for a new wife, who does he go to? To Yishmael. To marry another wife. Marsha gives an explanation over here in the Moshul. Well, they're relatives, but the point is that he's going dafka. He knows, as he says in the pasuk, that the Bnois Ches are displeasing to Yitzchak and Rivka. But of all people, he goes to Yishmael, who himself is a flawed kind of person, and marries his daughter. So Marsha gives a long explanation over here. You know, here the Moshul, in the Moshul, we're mentioning a bad palm tree, meaning that it doesn't produce fruit, but it comes. It's a palm tree, after all. It comes from good stock. Esav also came from good stock. His parents are Yitzchak and Rivka, both tzaddikim. But he chose to be bad. He chose to be like that palm tree that's useless and doesn't bear fruit. And now who does he go to? He goes to Yishmael, who is like this kina de shorchi, also like this this useless and not fruit-bearing tree, in the sense that, in other words, here... He goes to someone where Yishmael is not even of good lineage on both sides. His father is Avram Avinu, but his mother is Hagar. So therefore, like, he likes to associate with him, Davka. So it really fits the Moshul much better. Marshal says that's why why didn't the Gemara bring the pasuk that Esav married women from Benois Ches? Because then you wouldn't really have the same kind of thing. Fine, Benois Ches, yeah, they have no decent yichus at all. But Yishmael at least has some kind of yichus on his father's side. He can therefore be compared to a tree, just a useless tree that's not producing fruit. And Esav himself is like a bad palm tree that's also producing no fruit or very inferior fruit.
What can we do about it anyway?
What can we do about it? So a person should realize for himself, for one thing, if he sees that he's attracting no good nicks around him, then he himself should realize that maybe he's not where he belongs. If he's attracting them around them, and he's going to be mashpia on them, if he's going to be a shliach, and you have all of the people who are not where they're supposed to be assembling to him, adadab, that's a good thing. He'll make them into, instead of kina de shorchi, instead of a non-fruit-bearing tree, he'll make them over into fruit-bearing trees, because they're hay, but, yeah. Shonu ibn Nevi'im, this point is repeated in Nevi'im, and the Ion Yaakov makes a point. If you only had it in Chumash, you could say, okay, it was a one-off. It so happens that Esav went to Yishmael. But when you see again in Nevi'im and again in Ksuvim, etc., then you realize this is a very strong tendency in human affairs, that this happens over and over. So in Nevi'im, Dichtiv, we have the story over there with Yifta HaGiladi. He was born from a Pilegesh, and his family kicked him out. And what does the pasuk say? He went to a different country. Vayislakdo Yifta Anoshim Reikim. Empty people gathered to Yifta Vayetsu Ima, and they would go out and then fight battles together with him. So we see that Yifta himself, who also, Marshal says, it's a similar kind of thing. He comes from flawed lineage. His father was Gilad, a respectable Yid, but his mother was a Pilegesh. The pasuk actually calls her Isha Zoyna. What that means is a whole other question. But anyway, the point is that he came from like not such great stock, and who comes and assembles around him are Noshim Reikim, empty people. So, so like he attracted these types to him because he himself was of that type himself. Eventually became a shofet. Fine, you know, we say Yiftach Bedoda Kishmul Bedoda. Once he's a shofet, you have to have derech eretz for him, but nevertheless, he was not exactly one of the high caliber shoftim. Then it's this concept is repeated a third time in Ksuvim. Now, what the Gemara is going to bring here is not actually from Ksuvim. It's actually from Sefer Ben Sira. We've talked about before Ben Sira is written, I think it's the author lived near the beginning of the second Beis Hamikdash. He was a contemporary of Shimon HaTzadik. He describes him in really glowing terms. Some of the phrases that he uses about him, we use in the Piyut Ko'el HaNimtach that we say on Yom Kippur to describe the radiance of the Kohen Gadol. Anyway, it's a Sefer. A lot of large parts of it are in the style of Mishlei and other Sfarim of Tanakh like that. So it wasn't written with Ruach HaKodesh, but people often thought of it as a book of Tanakh because it's similar in style. The Gemara calls it Sfarim Chitzonim, and the Chachamim banned learning it, and over time, the original Lashon Kodesh of it was lost. Eventually, they found parts of it in the Cairo Gniza. In any case, here the Gemara is quoting from it as if it's literally part of Ksuvim, which it's not, but it's Ksuvim in the broader sense. It was something that was already written. Because like this, at this point, in the time of the Gemara, nothing had been written yet except for Tanakh, and nothing had been allowed according to the din to be written of Torah, except for the 24 books of Tanakh, and Megillas Kainis, which lists days during the second Beis Hamikdash when we celebrate for various Nisim that Hashem did. So here, this was it wasn't really authorized to be written, but it was written, and so the Gemara refers to it in a looser sense as Ksuvim. Anyway, so Ben Sira says, Kol oif lemina yishkon, every bird dwells together with its own species, and similarly people associate with people who are like them. It's very clearly expressing this idea that an empty person tends to associate with empty people and vice versa. Then we have Tnan b'masnissin, we have a Mishnah expressing this idea. Now you have like this, there are different kinds of kalim, some of which are makabel truma and some of which are not. For example, one of the basic rules of the halachas of truma v'tara when it comes to kalim is that flat wooden kalim in general are not makabel truma. So if you have, for example, let's say you have a menorah made out of wood, and we don't mean a menorah with receptacles in it like we light on Hanukkah, a menorah of wood would be more like a stand, that then you take a lamp and you put it on that stand. The stand itself is a flat wooden keli, and so it's not makabel truma. So now, a Mishnah says, kol hamechubar latomei tomei, if something is attached, for example, a hook is attached to something which is makabel truma, then the hook is also makabel truma. So for example, let's say a table or bench or things like that, where the keli is makabel truma, if you attach a hook to it, to hang it on the wall or whatever, then the hook is also makabel truma. Kol hamechubar latoher toher, and vice versa, if the hook is attached to, for example, a wooden menorah, a wooden lampstand, then even though the hook is made out of metal, and metal is usually makabel truma, but here it becomes bottled to the wooden stand, and therefore it's not makabel truma either. So we see that a thing gains the status of what it's attached to. The hook is attached to and bottled to the keli that it's attached to, and therefore it has the same status. So you see this idea again that light goes together with light as far as people and as far as objects. But tanena b'braisa, and then we have a braisa expressing the same idea. The Gemara in Chulin discusses what birds are and aren't kosher. We know the Torah lists 24 types that are not kosher. Nowadays, we're not sure what those 24 are, so we need a Masorah. But the Gemara discusses about a few different species, whether they're kosher or not. One of them is called a zarzir in Hebrew, and in English it's called a starling. So the Chacham holds it's a kosher bird. It doesn't have the simone truma. And in those times, I guess they had a masorah on it, so fine. But Rabbi Eliezer says, no. You should know, the zarzir is in fact not a kosher bird. He says, in fact, when the pasuk says about the raven, es kol orev lamino, it says all ravens according to their species. Whenever it says lamino or lamina by a species in the Torah, it means that there are related types that are not identical to it, but they're closely enough related in genetics or in appearance or in habits or whatever, that they're included in the same category. So Rabbi Eliezer says the zarzir in fact is a non-kosher bird, and he says, I'll tell you why. Loy lachinam holach zarzir oitzel oirim. It's not for nothing that the zarzir, the starling, goes together and flies and hangs out together with the raven, elam pneshu minay. The reason is because they're both the same general species. And therefore, since the oirim is treif, then so is the zarzir because it's part of that species as well. So again, you see the idea that Rabbi Eliezer is saying, you know why the zarzir, how we know that the zarzir is a non-kosher bird? Because it hangs out with non-kosher birds. Marsha points out, here also you have the, like he explained about Esav and Yishmael, you have a similar kind of idea. The Gemara lists there in Cholin, strictly speaking, there are four simonim. If a bird has all four simone tumah, then it's definitely non-kosher. If it has none of them, then it's definitely kosher. And if it has some of them, then you need to see whether it's on the list or not. Now, the raven, the Gemara explains over there, has two of the simone tumah. Or another way of looking at it, in other words, it's lacking two of the simone tara. The zarzir does not. Nevertheless, the Rabbi Eliezer says, even though objectively you would have looked at it by itself and think, well, it doesn't have the simone tumah, what's the problem? But because it associates with the raven, then therefore that tells us that it's not kosher. Okay. Another one. Minoha milsa da'amri inshi. Where do we have a source in Torah for an expression that people say, idolis dura, if you will help lift up the burden with me, dolina, then I'll carry it. The eloi, and if not, loy dolina, then I won't carry it. So it's a figure of speech that people say. For example, let's say you have a risky investment or something. You want me to take on this risk. I'm not going to do it unless you're willing to join in together with me and pull the risk together. So where is there a source in Torah for that? Ion Yaakov points out it could even be when there's a dvar mitzvah involved, but there might be potential sakana involved. So a person might say, even though this is a dvar mitzvah and that gives a person protection, nevertheless, I don't want to enter into that risk unless you're willing to come along with me as well. So where is there a source in Torah for that being a valid concept? Amalei. So he answers, so Rav Abamari answers, Dichtiv, you find in Sefer Shoftim, when Devorah tells Barak that we have to go fight a war against Sisra and Yovan Melech Chotzer and that whole gang, so go gather together men from Naphtali and Zvolun and go fight the war. So Vayomer Elea Barak says to Devorah, Im Telchi Imi, if you will go with me, Vahalachti, then I'll go, Vim Loi Telchi Imi, and if you won't go with me, Loi Elech, then I won't go. So like he's expressing the same idea as in this popular adage, if you're willing to come with me and help me, and help me with it, then I'm willing to do it, but if not, then I'm not willing to take the risk on. Pnei Yeshua points out, you know, when you get down to it, it's not as though Devorah is actually going to help in the battle anyway. Now, women don't fight in battles, at least it's not supposed to be Al-Pi Torah that they do, so it's not like she's going to be helping to fight the battle, so therefore, that this bears out the expression, even when you're talking about it, it is a burden or it is a risk that one person could handle all by himself. Nevertheless, it's a valid thing for him to say, you know what, I don't really want to go into this all by myself, only if you're willing to lend me some kind of support. Okay. Another one. Amalei Rava L'Rava Bar Mari. Minoha Milsa Da'amri Inshi. Where is there a source in Torah for the popular expression? Kalba B'Kafne. When a dog is hungry, Galilei Mivla. He will swallow Galilei. What are Galilei? Rashi says two explanations. One is that means stones. So when a dog is hungry, and Marsha refers to a Gemara in Shabbos that says that dogs in general have very little food for them, have very little food available to them. We're not talking about like pet dogs that people keep. We're talking about like wild dogs, like feral dogs that run around in the streets. They have very little food available to them. The Eidishter gives them a special chesed that it takes them 3 full days to digest their food, so that way at least they feel fuller for a longer period. But when a dog like that, who has very little food available to him, when he's hungry, he'll even eat stones, which are inedible. Or Rashi says the second explanation is Galilei, means glolim, means dung, means waste. Rashi says I prefer the first explanation because dogs eat waste, excrement like that all the time, even if they're not hungry. So therefore, better the first. So therefore, there'd be no chiddush in that. The chiddush would be more that if he's hungry, he'll eat even rocks. So in other words, the point of the expression is that when a person is desperate, he'll do anything. So where's there a source in Torah for that? Dichtiv, the Pasuk in Mishlei, Nefesh Sveya, a satisfied soul, when a person feels satisfied, Tovus Nefesh, he will reject even the honeycomb. So like you offer him a sweet, delicious thing, a honeycomb, and he'll reject it because he's full. The Nefesh Ve'eva, but a hungry soul, Kol Marmosek, to it, anything bitter, it feels as sweet. So like here, like the hungry dog will even eat stones. Yad Yosef refers over here. There's actually a pasuk that refers to v'haklovim as a nefesh lo yodu sava. The dogs are chutz b'tikah creatures. They don't know how to be full. In other words, they're never satisfied. So therefore, nefesh re'eva of the pasuk in Mishlei can well be referring to dogs that always feel hungry, that always act like they're hungry and they'll eat anything that's available. Okay. Amalei Rava Mori, Minoha Milsa Da'amni Inchi. Where is there a source in Torah for the popular expression, koris chavrach v'loi onach, if you called to your friend, meaning Rashi says to give him musr, v'loi onach, and he didn't reply to you, he didn't accept, he wasn't willing to even listen to you, romi guda rabba, or dochi guda rabba, throw or push a big wall, shodi bay, and throw it on him. In other words, leave him alone at that point, don't bother trying to give him musr anymore, let him just die in his rishus. As Rashi's explanation. The Foshim talk about a variety of things we do find in other places where you are supposed to give a person musr, so what are you saying over here? If he's not receptive, then you just give up on him and metaphorically throw a wall on him. In other words, let him just die in his rishus. How does that fit with hecheyach techiach v'meyapamim? So among the explanations is there's a difference over here. We're talking about he won't even listen to you at all. He doesn't even want to hear that you have a point of view. So then you may as well not bother. As opposed to if he's willing to, there's a distinction. For example, is it that he knows he's doing wrong and just he has a yetzahara, he has a hard time overcoming it. So fine, give him musr again and again, as many times, eventually maybe it'll sink in. As opposed to if he's the kind of person, he's not even willing to listen, as far as he's concerned, what he's doing is completely right. To use a phrase from the pasuk, Al Omrich Loichot, Hashem says, Hinini Nishpat Oisach. Hashem says, I'm going to punish you Jewish people. Al Omrich Loichot Tosi, because you're saying I'm not doing anything wrong. Like you won't even accept that what you're doing is wrong. So then in that case, there's no sense giving him Musr after a while. He's not going to be receptive anymore if he's determined in his mind that what I'm doing is right. And then we're saying over here, then leave him alone and let him just die in his rishus. The Rosh, actually, there's a parenthetical note inserted over here in Rashi, that the Rosh, in his Pesachim on Ar Masechta, brings from the Goinim another meaning of this Gemara, another meaning of this expression, that if you called him and he didn't come, push a wall on him, it means, if you have a Din Torah against somebody, and you're summoning him to Beis Din, and he refuses to come, then you are allowed to, metaphorically, push a big wall on him, namely take him to the Goyish courts, and get what's owing to you that way. Normally, it's a very serious Aveda to take a fellow Yid to a Goyish court, to our Koris Chalakum, but where he won't even listen to the Beis Din summons, then you can get permission from the Beis Din and take him to a secular court. And that's also included in this phrase of the Gemara over here. So where's a source in the Torah for this whole concept? Omalei, so Rabbi Bamori answers, Dichtiv, as you have a pasuk in Yechezkel, the Eibishter says to the Jewish people, Yan tihautich, because I'm trying to make you pure, v'loi tahort, but you are not becoming pure, mitum osech, lo sitari oid, you will not become cleansed of your tumah anymore. In other words, Hashem is basically saying, so to speak, like I'm giving up on you. You're not going to listen to my musr, you're not going to try to become tahor. And Marsha explains, actually, the end of the pasuk is, Hashem says, ad hanichias chamosi boch, Hashem says, until I place my anger assuage my anger against you. In other words, Hashem is saying, eventually you're going to have to go through terrible tzaris, which will, so to speak, then Hashem says, then I won't have what to be angry at you anymore, because then I'll taken it out on you with punishment. So the same way over here, like we're saying over here, Hanicho, leave him alone, and he'll fall into his vicious. So Hashem is saying basically the same thing. You're not receptive to what the Nevi'im are having to say. You're going to have to go through terrible Yisurim that are comparable to a wall falling on you, and then at that point, that's how it's going to have to be dealt with, because it can't be dealt with any other way. Where's a source in Torah for another popular expression? Beira de shosis mine maya, a well from which you drank water, don't throw a clod of dirt into it. In other words, it's a metaphorical way of saying, if you used something once, if you benefited from something once, then don't treat it casually and disrespectfully. Show a little derech eretz for it, because you used it in the past, and who knows, you might need it in the future, but even if not, the very fact that you had hanah from it in the past means you should have a little gratitude for it. We find, for example, that Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't hit the Nile by the first three makas, because it protected him, and therefore he delegated that to Aaron, and the same thing with the makah of Kinyan, because the earth had covered up the body of the Mitzri. So where's an explicit source in Torah for that? Omalei, so Rabbi Bamori answers in Dichtiv. You have the pasuk, Lois the Saiv Adoimi, don't reject an Adoimi completely from joining the Jewish people, ki achichahu, because he's your brother, and therefore, as the pasuk says, a grandson of an Adoimi Geir can intermarry into the Jewish people freely. And here's the point that we're quoting, that here's the point that Rabbi Bamori is getting at, but the pasuk continues, Lois the Saiv Mitzri, don't reject a Mitzri, ki Gerho Yisavarza, because you were a Ger, you were a guest in his land, because they originally invited you in a friendly way. So in other words, even though, as Rashi points out on the pasuk, you would think you should reject them completely. They were horrible to the Jewish people in Mitzrayim. They threw the babies into the Nile. They did all kinds of other crimes against the Jewish people. Nevertheless, they were achsanya b'shas adchak. Nevertheless, when you were in a bad situation during the famine in Mitzrayim, during the famine in Eretz Canaan, then they gave you hospitality, and for that reason, you shouldn't completely reject them. So in a similar vein, you have this well. One time, you were desperate for water, and you drank from it. So therefore, afterwards, show it a little derech eretz and don't throw a clod of dirt into it. So again, you have this idea that Moshe Rabbeinu does by the Makkos, and the idea is, of course, it's not like the Nile or the well or the dirt or whatever is going to feel anything, but it develops a sense of a midah Torah by the person himself. When he himself acts in that way, that this inanimate object deserves my thanks, and that helps him develop more of a sense of gratitude to other people and to the Eidishter. The Rimi Gash tells a story in this connection involving his Rebbe, the Rif. The Rif one time wasn't feeling well, and there was a Yid in his community who had him as a guest for a while in his house. And the Yid had a bathhouse, and he gave the Rif free permission to use the bathhouse to help strengthen his health. Eventually, this Yid became poor, went bankrupt. He had to sell the bathhouse, and the local basin has to decide about the disposition of the bathhouse and the various furniture in it and whatnot. And the Rif says, I'm recusing myself from dealing with that. Even though I'm one of the local dayanim, because I benefited from this bathhouse, I'm not now going to be part of a basin that's going to supervise taking it apart and selling all the assets of it. A similar idea, in other words, that I benefited from this well metaphorically, and therefore I'm not going to throw a clod of dirt into it. Okay, the Gemara continues. The Ben Yehoyada points out, by the way, another way of understanding the metaphor is the well that we're talking about is the person's mouth, which is like a well that wells forth Torah. So a person should be careful. Don't throw a clod of dirt into it. Make sure you don't put into it something which is not kosher or questionably kosher or whatever. That would be like befouling the water, the place where you're getting your life-giving water from. Where's a source in Torah for the popular expression? People say, had havenan zutri, when we were youngsters, legavri, then people treated us respectfully like we were adult men. Hashta de kashishna, but now that we're older, ledaritiki, then they treat us like little kids. Well, you know, we know mice and b'chol yom. Unfortunately, it happens sometimes that people don't show the proper respect to senior citizens or people in nursing homes or whatever. So that's one meaning of the mushal. There's a few other explanations that Mefarshim have of what it means. Anaf Yosef brings an interesting one over here that you have the Medrash has an expression when baby chicks when a chicken lays eggs and they hatch and chicks are born when they're young, when they're babies, then the mother feeds them and actually, you know, chews up the food, and it chews whatever chickens don't chew, but whatever, takes the food in its beak and then mashes it up and gives it to them. Then later on, when the chicks are older and they come to the mother for food, she like pushes them away, go get your food yourself. So that's another way of understanding this this phrase over here, that when the person is little, then the Eidishter shows him tremendous individual ashtocha pratis, but as he becomes older, then he doesn't necessarily enjoy that close ashtocha pratis. Now he's expected more to stand on his own 2 feet, and of course he still has to have constant betochen in the Eidishter, but he's not going to necessarily show him on an ongoing basis such a closeness. So where's there a source in Torah for that? Ben Yehoyada has another way of understanding it is also that Ben Yehoyada and a couple of other Mefarshim talk about a way of understanding it is that, again, this is something that I think we can all relate to. When we're youngsters, we feel like we know it all, like we're adults and we know it all. But then we get older and we realize that how childish we are, we realize how much we yet have to learn. So where's there a source in Torah for that? Amalei, so Rabbi Bamari tells him, let's consider what happened with the Jewish people in the Midbar. Me'ikra ksiv, to begin with, when Hashem is first taking the Jewish people out of Mitzrayim, v'Hashem ho'ilach lifneim yoimam, Hashem was going before them by day, v'amud anon, with a pillar of fire, l'anchoisim aderach, to show them the way, v'layla, and by night, v'amud esh l'hor lahem, with a pillar of fire to show them, to light up the way for them. So to speak, Hashem is personally accompanying them and showing them the way. All of a sudden, then what happens eventually, Hashem tells Moshe, I'm going to send a malach before you, the Shmor Chabaderach, to guard you on the way. So like Hashem is, so to speak, withdrawing his closer personal Ashgacha on the Jewish people and delegating it to a malach. So again, this idea, in other words, that here when we were little, we're being treated respectfully like adults, and Hashem himself is going to help us, and then afterwards, when we're more mature, then Hashem is going to, is kind of like going to downgrade us. Marsha points out that also you have like this in Mitzrayim. Hashem personally brought Makas Choshech and caused that the Mitzrayim have utter darkness and the L'chol B'nei Yisrael Hayor Moshvosam. And here afterwards, Hashem is, so to speak, delegated to the Gdolei Malchus, to the important ministers such as the Malachim. Mind you, the Gemara elsewhere says, it actually brings it on the pasuk, that Moshe absolutely turned that down. Moshe said, if you send a malach, then we're not leaving over here. We want you, Hashem yourself, to continue leading us. And Hashem gave in, so to speak, and granted that, and only in Yeshua's times does a malach come and tell him, from now on, I'm leading you. Okay, but you have this idea, in other words, that a person is treated differently when he's a child or when he's an adult, or that a person himself realizes when he's little how much he has, when he's little he thinks that he knows it all, and when he gets older he realizes how much more he has yet to accomplish, etc. Another one. Where's a source in Torah for the popular expression, Bosa Mori Nixi, after the person who has a lot of nechosim, the rich person, Sivi Meshoich, then pieces of fat are drawn forth from him, or like trail after him. So in other words, it's a way of saying that Siv means pieces of fat, or some Meforshim explain means it means more like strips. But in other words, it's a way of saying, in other words, you hang out with rich people, then some of their riches will rub off on you as well. So where is there a source in Torah for that? Amalei, he says, Dichtiv, you have in last week's parasha, the Gamla Loit HaHoylechas Avraham, also Loit who went with Avraham, and as Rashi points out on the Pasuk, there's no particular reason in that context to say that he went with Avraham. We know from the beginning of the parasha already that he's accompanying Avraham. Hoyat Sonu Vokav Olam, he had sheep and cattle and tents. So the point is, how did he get all that by associating with Avraham?
Wasn't he was rewarded for not telling?
There is the fact that he got a reward for not telling on Sarah that she's Avraham's wife, yeah, but we're saying the fact that he's hanging out with Avraham, the fact that he stayed together with Avraham, is what brought him all these riches. The fact that he didn't tell on Sarah, actually, Rashi mentions in this week's parasha, that's one source that saved him when Sodom was destroyed. There's the fact that he didn't tell on Sarah, yeah. And by the way, I mean, you could think of it as follows. In a way, actually, that tells us something about Lloyd. I mean, you think about it. So he's quiet and he doesn't say. So he makes, so he's allowing everybody to think that Sarah is Avraham's sister. And then when Parai wants Sarah, who is he sending all the cattle and the servants and everything is to Avraham. Lloyd could have easily said, wait a minute, she's not Avraham's sister, she's my sister. And he'd be getting all those riches. So the fact that he didn't, the fact that he was quiet and kept that, it's a schus. And therefore, so the Eibishter have rewarded him in this world that he does taka have tzonu vokav olam. Fine. So that's the end of all of the things that Rava is asking Rava Bar Mori for things for a source and a pasuk for different things. Now the Gemara is going to go to another point. One of the things we mentioned during all of these questions of Rava to Rava Bar Mori is that if somebody says something derogatory about you, then accept it. So metaphorically, like if they tell you you're a donkey, put a saddle on your back. And we mentioned in this connection the story with Hagar, where she ran away from Sarah and thought herself to be independent, but the Malach tells her, Hagar Shivcha Sarai, you're after all the maidservant of Sarai. And Hagar concedes and says, fine. So now the Gemara is going to bring something in that connection, and also in connection of the story of Sarah and Hagar and Avraham, but also it also connects in general with, we're talking in this parak about a person has been injured or harmed by somebody else where he's entitled to compensation. Now there can be a situation where what he does is instead of or in addition to going to Beis Din, he also demands that Hashem should punish the other person. So now the Gemara is going to talk about that. Omer of Chanin, kol most of din al chaveroi. If a person gives over a din about somebody else to Hashem, so he has a complaint about somebody else, and he goes and complains to Hashem that that person should be punished, hu nanesh chila, the one who made the complaint gets punished first. There's a number of reasons that explain why that should be, what's so bad about it. One thing is because bringing down din of the Eibishter into the world, and that has effects that go far beyond him. There's the idea that when he's doing that, then it causes Hashem to say, well, wait a minute, are you such a tzaddik yourself that because this other person injured you, then you're worthy enough of having him punished on you because of you. So therefore, that causes his own books to be opened and checked in Shemayim. And b'chol, there's an idea, the Gemara says in Shabbos, kol mi shachaveru nena shal yod. Anybody where somebody else was punished in Shemayim because of him, that person who it happened because of him is not going to be allowed into the inner partition, so to speak, with Hashem. He's not going to have the highest levels of Gan Eden. So it all goes with this idea. Therefore, so a person doesn't have any business doing that. Instead of complaining to Hashem, go to the Beis Din on earth. So kolam moisa din achaber who nenesh chila. Shenemar in the story with Hagar over there, that Tomer is after what happens. So Hagar becomes pregnant and she starts belittling Sarah, as Rashi says. She's saying Sarah must not be the tzaddikas she claims to be. She's been barren so many years. I got pregnant right away. By the way, the Medrash says on that, you know, it's the same way as, for example, you have a garden, the weeds will grow right away. The actual plants that you want to cultivate, those, it takes a lot of hard work.
So,
she says to him, I have my wrong is against you, meaning I'm holding you responsible for the fact that Hagar is behaving this way. And she says, Yishpat, as she finishes off the pasuk, she says, Yishpat Hashem beni uveinecha, may Hashem judge between me and you, which is a moisture din l'shamayim. In effect, she's saying that she's asking that Hashem should judge the case and do to Avraham whatever's appropriate for the fact that she was insulted.
Based on what did she say?
She's saying, you know, it was basically, she's saying to Avraham.
But basically, what? What was she blaming Avraham for?
She was blaming Avraham because she's saying, I gave my maidservant as a wife to you, and you're seeing her insult me and claiming that I'm a hypocrite, and you're not doing anything about it. And you're, after all, you're her boss, you're her husband, you're supposed to tell her something.
So the complaint was, Sarah said, you daven for yourself.
You daven for yourself and you daven for me also. Yeah, Rashi mentions that also, yeah. So she says, Yishpat Hashem ben yu v'necha, may Hashem judge between me and you. In other words, this is Moisir Din L'Shamayim. In effect, she's saying that I want Hashem to take up my case and then execute judgment against you on my behalf.
She did that probably instead, but I don't believe that's wrong.
No, of course Avraham is not hurting her knowingly, but he didn't do anything
he didn't hear.
Okay, but Sarah figured that he should have heard, that he should have paid attention. I don't know. Anyway, well, Uchtiv, eventually the Pasuk says that Sarah passed away earlier than Avraham. By Yahweh Avraham, this is for the Sarah of Koisa, that Avraham came to bewail and cry for Sarah. Why? In other words, so she passed away first. No.
So that's a raya.
She was Moser Dina Havera. She said Hashem should...
How is this a riot?
So this is a riot.
She passed away.
Ah, so, one second. So Marsha explains like this. We would have expected that Sarah should live at least as long as Avraham. Like this, she lived many years less than him. She lived to 127. Avraham, mind you, she was younger than him too. She's 10 years younger. She might even, B'derech HaTeva, outlived him. But, in other words, the point is that Marsha says, if the Torah was just telling us the fact that she passed away first, then it would have said, or whatever, that Avraham cried and bewailed Sarah. The expression "vayyovay Avraham," that Avraham came, in other words, there was a short period, in other words, like this. When Sarah passed away, Avraham was not there, because it was right after the Akedah, as the possibility of Vayeshev Avraham beBeersheva, he stayed in Beersheva for a while, and only when he found out that Sarah had passed away, then Vayyovay Avraham, then he came to Hebron to mourn her, and so forth. So it comes out, and like this, Marsha says, normally, when a wife passes away, it's a terrible thing for her, but it's also a horrible thing for her husband, that his wife, who he's been married to for many years, passes away. But here, it wasn't right away. Avraham didn't find out about it right away. It took time. Therefore, in that sense, we can say that Sarah was punished before Avraham. Before Avraham ever found out about it, she's already passed away. Therefore, the Gemara specifically quotes the pasuk Vayavar Avraham Lusper Lusara Velukosa. In other words, that this shows not just that Sarah passed away before Avraham. We have other pasukim that show that point, but that Avraham wasn't there, and therefore that the punishment hit her before any consequences of it hit Avraham. And why is that? Because she was Moser Din Mashamayim. Otherwise, she might well have outlived him, or otherwise she might well have outlived him.
It wasn't it. There's no cell phones there, I expect.
No, that's the point. In other words, the Eibishter could have easily... No. The point is, the Eibishter could easily have arranged that she passed away when Avraham is back in Hebron. But then that would have been, it would be a punishment on her, but it would equally well, at the same moment, be a punishment for Avraham. Because his wife has just passed away. Like this instead, because he was away in Beersheba, and it took him some time until the news reached him, and he hurried back to Hebron. Meanwhile, during that time, there was a punishment for her, there was a poronus for her, before there was for Avraham. Now, why should that be? Why did the Eibishter arrange that? Because she was Moser Din Lashamayim, we're saying.
And Hashem must have sent that it was a malach who told her?
You have different opinions, whether it was a malach, or whether it was the sultan or whatever, that told her that the Akedah had about that, and that almost happened, and yeah, her neshama flew away, yeah. However, the Gemara says, "V'hani mili di isla yayona ba'ara." Now, this would only apply, though, only if the person who's Moser Din HaChaveri has a dayan on earth who can deal with the situation. So, if there's a Beis Din available where he could have gone to, and instead of doing that, he says, "You know what? I can't be bothered with Beis Din. Hashem, punish this person for what he did for me." Then that's Moser Din HaChaveri, and there are serious consequences. But here, but if there's no dayana ba'ara, then he's perfectly entitled to do that. So now Tosfos says that in that time there was the Beis Din of shame. So therefore, if Sarah has a problem with what Avraham is doing or not doing about the way Hagar is behaving, then she should go to the Beis Din of shame and then lodge a formal complaint over there and bring Avraham to a Din Torah. Why instead is she Moser Din Lashamayim? The Marsha brings from the Ran a different explanation, that she should have told Avraham himself first. Like this, it's all in one thing. She says, Hamasi alacha, yishpert Hashem b'ni uvaynecha. First, she should have come to Avraham. You know, Avraham, Hagar is acting in a chutzpahdik way to me. Do something about it. Then, if he doesn't do anything about it, then she has a right to be Moser Din HaChaveri. But, yeah. Okay, so the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Yitzchak, Oiloi Latsoyek Yosem LeNitzach. In this connection, same idea. The person who cries out to Hashem to cause the other person to be punished is a woe to him more than the one who's being cried about. Tanya Nami, in other words, again, because he's Moser Din HaChaveri, and therefore who nanesh tchilach. Tani Nami Hochi, we learn similarly in a Braisa. Echad atsoyek ve'echad anitzak b'mashma. When the posik, now the posik says like this, the posik in Parashas Mishpatim describes that if a person mistreats a yosem or an almana, so the posik says, be careful, don't make sure you don't hurt their feelings or anything, because the posik says, ki tsoyek yitzak elai, if they cry out to me, shamoya eshmat tzakos, and then Hashem says, I will certainly hear their cry. And then the posik continues, v'chora api, Hashem says, my anger will flare, v'horagti eschem v'chorev, and I will kill you, plural, with the sword. Who's the you plural? The Gemara's understanding, it means both the tzoyek and the nitzak. Because again, we're talking about over here, the yosem u'amana. Yes, they were very badly insulted or wronged or whatever. Nevertheless, they should have gone to Beis Din instead of crying out right away to the Eibishter. So therefore, when the Eibishter's anger flares because of that complaint, then v'haragdi eschem, it ends up hitting both of them. The tzoyek, the one who cried, and the nitzak. Elishma marim of tzoyek, yosem and nitzak, but the one who cries out and calls down a punishment from Hashem on the other person is punished even faster than the one who was cried about, again, as we have with the example with Sarah and Avraham, where she ended up passing away first, and as Marsha says, even before Avraham had a chance to find out about it. So in other words, the point of it is, there are cases where a person can be Moser Din Lashamayim, but he has to be careful about it. Don't just willy-nilly go and start calling down, Hashem should punish this guy. You don't speak like that against a fellow Yid, unless, like we're saying, there's no Dayana Ba'ar, there's no Dayan on earth who can or will take the case, then you're entitled to, but otherwise, leave it up to the Dayanim on earth, and leave it up to the Eibishter to decide what punishments are appropriate above and beyond that, rather than you calling down Din against a fellow Yid. We started talking about yesterday that Eber was talking about Nesicha. Why is it that Davka, our orphaned dur, is going to be Zoicha to Gola? So the Rebbe had pointed out the idea that we're midgets on the shoulders of giants and we can see further. So now the Rebbe talks about there are certain areas in which our dur has a greater mila. In particular, in the matter of Mesiras Nefesh and Kabbalah Soil. We don't have the, it's not the same kind of Mesiras Nefesh as they had back in the day of being willing to be killed for Yiddishkeit. We don't have that nowadays, basically, Baruch Hashem, but you have a different kind, a higher kind of Mesiras Nefesh, and a higher kind of Kabbalah's oil that when we're in free, prosperous countries and everything, and when there's a deeper Golos, so, and we find, even it says in Chassidus, that when the Pasuk says that Moshe was very humble, Mikol Adam Asher Al Pnei HaAdama, that Moshe was particularly humble in his own eyes, when he looked at the later generations right before Mashiach's times, our generation, that he sees there's such a tremendous darkness and obscurity and uncertainty in the world, and we're still Osik and Torah and Mitzvahs, and we still have Nesidas Nefesh and Kabbalah Soil, Moshe was so overawed by that evoked by him a tremendous anivus. So that's where we have that advantage over the previous generations. Continuing in Hilchos and Halachos of getting dressed in the morning. So we were talking about the idea a person has to keep his body covered when he's getting dressed and undressed. So the Alter Rebbe had digressed to talk about when a person is bathing, how to do. So now, when a person is getting dressed and he's putting on his shirt, he should be careful to put it right side out and not inside out with the stitches sticking out, because then he'll look degraded in people's eyes. People are going to think that he's a schlump. If he wasn't careful and put it on inside out, so if he's a Talmud Chacham, then he has to take it off and put it on the right way, because otherwise, as the Pasuk says, Misana, I call Misana, anybody who causes Hashem to be hated and disrespected by people, is very serious consequences. So like this, a Talmud Chacham in particular dresses like that in a schlumpy way, then it causes people to lose respect for the Eibishter and for Yiddishkeit to some extent. I mean, even though we often say that in some areas of Halacha, we don't really have Talmud Chacham of that kind of certain calibers nowadays, but in that sense, any Yid who is openly a Frum Yid may well be in that category. Then also, Alpi Kabbalah, a person has to be careful not to put on two items of clothing at once. It's Kosher L'Shikcha. It makes a person forgetful. Then another din, as far as putting on clothing, is that a person should always do the right first. We find the right is very important in Kol HaTorah Kula. The Kohenim do the Avodah and the Bais Mikdash with their right hand. When the Metzora has the blood of his korban and the oil of his korban applied to his body, it goes on the right ear and the right thumb and the right toe, and by the Miluyim and by Chalitza. So a person should always, so you have to put the right first. So a person is putting on shoes, you put on your right shoe first. And when you take off the left shoe first, because again, that shows honor to the right foot by keeping it dressed in the shoe longer.
You dress up, equally dress or undress the bathroom as under the blankets, or under the blankets is better?
It seems like from what the Alter Rebbe is saying, that under the blankets is better. I mean, again, in the bathroom, you have to uncover parts of your body to go or to urinate or defecate or to take a shower, or your whole body for a shower, but the lavdafka as far as getting dressed. Anyway, when you have shoes with laces, you don't lace the right shoe first, then you lace the left shoe first. Because lacing and tying things is associated with tefillin, and there you should show more honor to the left, because the left arm is what you put tefillin on. Then if a person is a lefty, then he would flip those around because he puts tefillin on his right hand. So, because the point is, any time, we're saying in general you put the right side first, because it has a chshivus in many different mitzvahs, but when it comes to tying has more importance to the left because of the fact that we tie tefillin on our right arm. I mean, on our left arm. So if the shoes don't have laces, then you just put on. So in other words, if they have laces, you put on the right one, put on the left one, tie the left one, then tie the right one. Similarly, you put it on any other clothing. One second, put on any. That's fine. Let me fill in a minute. Check one to that.
I have a question.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Taking off clothing together. Two together is okay.
Putting on, it seems to be, is the issue, yeah, I guess. Then when similarly a person is putting on his shirt or other things, put on the right sleeve first, same thing pants, same thing socks, everything else, and again, anything that involves tying, you tie the left first. Similarly, when a person is bathing, he should first wash his right side and then his left side. Now, that's when he's doing individual parts of his body. If he's doing his whole body together, like in a bath or a shower, then he should wash his head first, because the head is Melech HaKolayvarim, the king over everything, so then the head goes first. But other than that, if he's just, for example, just washing his hands or his arms or whatever, then the right goes first. unless he's a lefty, and then a lot of these dinim are, some dinim as far as right versus left are different for lefties, some of them are not. There's actually a whole sefer I saw a few years back that goes systematically through that, through those things to explain which ones are different for lefties and which ones are not.
That's what I mean.